brings evaporation. Mornings, fresh, oxygen, cleanest. I take a deep hit, help my mind stay the greenest. I'm already awake, so I'm not drinking coffee. Don't want a cigarette, cause it's a form of slavery. Walk into the store, cause I need a few items. The sun heats my blood, like a hit of vitamins. I need to buy some food.
To KBOO's Hole in the Bucket. This is Michael Anderson, and I'm joined by Jay Thiemeyer.
Hello. Good evening.
Jay, how are you doing? Can you hear in your headphones?
I can hear fine.
Okay. I can sort of hear. All right. Good. Good. Then we're rolling out there, KBOO audience. Thank you for sticking with us. This is your community radio, and like your community, we may not always be ideal and beautiful, but we are deep. And so tonight on Hole in the Bucket, we have a bunch of different subjects we're going to cover, but front and center, we had to respond to last week. The federal government, the Bush administration, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development put out a preposterous news release talking about their accomplishments in reducing homelessness. I'm going to read a little bit from it, and then Jay and I are going to break it down about just how absurd this is. So HUD reports drop in number of chronically homeless persons living on the nation's streets. Decrease largely attributed to increase in supportive housing. For the first time ever, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is reporting a nearly 12% decrease in the number of chronically homeless persons living on the nation's street. HUD analysis, that should be in quotes, found that more than 20,000 persons moved from the streets into transitional and permanent supportive housing between 2005 and 2006. According to the data, 3,900 cities and counties across the country, HUD found that more than 15,000 reported a reduction in the number of long-term homeless persons over a one-year period. HUD's analysis indicated that a reduction of homeless people at 11.5% decrease. So on the surface of that would all sound very good, and certainly here locally we've heard a lot about 10-year plans and the work around them. But there's several, as with anything that comes out of the Bush administration, there are several inconsistencies, if not flat-out falsehoods. And then and we're going to talk about that a little bit, but then we're going to get deeper down, because I think, as we've said to you guys all along out there in the listening audience, like so many of these Bush programs, it purports to be one thing on the surface, but it's a very different thing behind the scenes. In other words, there's been an ongoing attack on affordable housing, health care, poverty-related safety net programs, all of which have made our problem worse rather than better. So to start out, you know, since 2001, HUD has spent $0 on the development of new public housing, while 100,000 units of public housing have been lost to demolition. So think about that for a while. Here, this press release champions that they've created 4,000 new units. We've lost 100,000. So right there, that's just preposterous that they would be celebrating this. They say that homelessness has dropped by 12%. But this, like the way that they measure unemployment rates, they've crafted a definition to carefully meet their own goals of being able to show a false success. You know, that opening line, for the first time ever, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development reports a decrease. Well, they never defined it that way before. So, of course, this can be the first time they're reporting a decrease.
Well, the critical thing is that it's 12% of the chronically homeless, that specific segment of the homeless population, which is basically around 1% of the total homeless count. And in the homeless count, it should be pointed out that the count they're using is very minimalized because it's through people accessing agencies. It doesn't involve outreach to places like Forest Park that we know about. People like that are not going to be counted under the regime that they use to make this homeless count. The reality is that, for example, chronically homeless locally, and regarding the waiting list for Section 8 vouchers, they are simply being bumped ahead of a waiting list that consists of, I think, 5,000 people. Is that right, Michael?
Yeah, I think in the metro area it's closer to 7,500 when we look at the metro housing authorities.
Yeah. They're overloaded, and it's simply a matter of bumping these people ahead as a showpiece.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, you know, as we've talked about the show time and time again, when you put the numbers right next to each other, what this country is spending on affordable housing compared to the much celebrated increase in funding for the homeless, you're still taking it maybe 1/20th of the housing budget is what's been allocated to this these plans to end homelessness. Maybe. At the same time, year after year, we are getting drastic cuts that literally are like taking scissors and snapping the cords of a net, and people are falling through every day.
What I have is Alphonso Jackson, the Secretary of HUD, who incidentally is on record as saying that he considers poverty all in the mind, that it's a matter of will. He doesn't have a real appreciation of the reality and or sympathy, obviously. He announced that 4,000 new units of permanent supportive housing have been created in this statement that he made recently. This is contradicted by the fact that he arbitrarily demolished 7,000 public housing units in New Orleans. When I was down there briefly, I saw some of these places near the French Quarter, Iberville in particular. They're made out of brick. Their foundations are solid. All they needed was renovation work and cleaning up the mold. But instead of doing that, he was catering to the developers. This was prime land next to the French Quarter. None of this is addressed, of course, and it totally contradicts his spin on things.
You know, another piece that just shows the degree of deceit involved in this press release is that, well, HUD, in their calculations of this decrease, maintains that there are 754,000 total people homeless on a given day. The Department of Education documents that there are over 900,000 children attending public school every day that are homeless. So which of these numbers is wrong? Are those kids going to school and making it up? You know, I don't think so. I think this is, once again, a total whitewashing of a spiral towards poverty that's not just affecting the chronically homeless, the people who've been on the streets for years, but creating a whole new potential class of people to live on the street, a whole new group of families who will grow up outside of having a stable place to call home.
And something to consider is that with the not just subprime lending crisis, but also prime lending, there are going to be mounting home foreclosures. This is going to press on the affordable housing market, and it's going to press downward so that people dealing with homelessness or near homelessness are going to have less of an opportunity to get out of that place and into affordable housing. The affordable housing market is already contracting. It's going to worsen because of this lending crisis and the subsequent home foreclosures.
So among the many different things that we bring this up to you, I mean, one, we are talking about it because I think very much the duty of this show is to talk honestly and candidly about the realities of homelessness and poverty. But, you know, there's also things, listeners out there, things that you can do. And we have an active KBOO audience, and I know you all are probably involved in a lot of things in making your voice heard. But one of the things that you can do this evening, tomorrow, is you can email our two senators, your representative. You can call them. All that stuff's on the web. Call them and say, we don't want fake reports from Housing and Urban Development. Because right now, at this very same time that HUD is putting out this load of baloney, the Bush administration is proposing to veto the HUD budget because it's close to adequately funding the Section 8 program and the Housing Authority budget. To be clear about that, we've talked about it before on the show, but for first-time listeners, so you know the details, the people who live in Housing Authority housing, the people who use a Section 8 voucher to make their rent affordable, if you take that away from those people, you best believe that it is very likely that they will be on the streets in 2 weeks to a couple months. And all of this is happening in a very planned-out, mechanized manner that has been carried out for three decades.
I'd like to specifically address that based on a new CBPP report. That's the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. I heard one of their people, Max Weisbrot, speaking on Old Mole about the home foreclosures and the lending crisis and so on. They're a wonderful outfit, cbpp.com, I guess, or .org. Their recent paper finds that the president's proposed cuts, the president has threatened to veto the bill now being voted on. It's the final House-Senate bill to fund HUD for 2008. The president has threatened to veto the bill unless Congress cuts it by $3 billion to reach the level he proposed. This new paper released by CBPP finds that the president's proposed cuts will have a harmful effect on key low-income housing and community development programs. Specifically, housing vouchers used by 25,000 families in 2007 will receive no renewal funding, and more than 15,000 new vouchers for homeless vets and other vulnerable families will not be funded. Total contradiction of the 10-year plan. Also, in public housing, the president's budget would impose the deepest funding shortfalls the program has ever experienced, exacerbating the recent deterioration in living conditions and security. Consider again the 7,000 arbitrarily demolished units in NOLA. Third, adoption of the president's funding levels would also eliminate $200 million in funding to mitigate the growing rates of mortgage defaults and foreclosures, cut $1.2 billion in funding for community development block grants, and sharply reduce funding to produce new affordable housing for people who are elderly or have disabilities. Supportive housing, in other words, that he's talking about the increase of 4,000 supportive housing units, and yet there's going to be a cut of $1.2 billion in these block grants, which are also going to affect supportive housing for elderly and people with disabilities.
And, you know, and what's really important here, I mean, the litany of things that the Bush administration has done that are of this very nature, you know, telling you it's up when it's down, that kind of crud is we become all too accustomed to dealing with it. But, you know, I know there's a lot of folks out in the cable audience that already feel an appropriate level of rage, but we cannot stand for this kind of, I'm trying not to swear on the air, but it gets really hard when you see this kind of damage being done to real people. This is a perfect example of when you might use the word collateral damage, because this ballyhooed campaign and homelessness has a huge collateral damage, which are all the other poor people who thought that they had a country that remotely cared for them. And at the same time that they get to see a headline that says, we're making progress, they know they're choosing between, can I put milk in the fridge? Can I get a new pair of pants for my kid? You know, absurd, unfair choices.
Additionally, Michael sort of addressed this, but this same report that I've mentioned from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, if you're not familiar with them, they're wonderful as far as low-income issues, especially homelessness and affordable housing. Their reports are a constant stream of really useful information. They mentioned shortfalls in funding for the renewal of project-based Section 8 rental assistance contracts would encourage private owners to terminate their participation in the Section 8 program, which would result, of course, in a substantial loss of affordable housing resources for very low-income families. Families who are homeless living in SRO motels, in their vehicles, in family shelters, whose capacity is minimal to begin with, but any prospect they have of moving out of that situation and getting a secure place of their own is being diminished by HUD. And that's the reality.
So the last thing we're going to leave you with on this subject, although everything we're talking about certainly relates and spills out of this subject, is I asked you tonight to get in contact with your senators and representatives. You can find them online. That's easy to do. I'm also going to give out the number for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. I would urge you to call them tomorrow and say, stop your trashy lies. You're destroying our country. Stop your trashy lies. Their number is 202-708-1112. You can ask for Alfonso Jackson. He's the secretary. He's the guy behind this, and we need to let him know. We don't hearken to his type of folk.
I would add to that, to put it in a local perspective, to contact HAP, the Housing Authority of Portland, and the BHCD, the Bureau of Housing and Community Development, and let them know that you don't like their collusion and acquiescence to the lies emanating from HUD.
I will say, on a quick note on that, I think that the Housing Authority of Portland has recently come around and started to make noise about the impact of these cuts. It's been slow in coming. I think everybody, when you get your place at the trough, it's hard to say what's going on. But the fact is that we're all being taken for a ride in a sham here, and we got to stand up. So now, Jay, you've put together a piece. As we enter into the winter season, the situation on the street becomes a lot worse. An already bad situation can become immediately deadly.
Yes, this is about the mats are down at Harbor Lights as of November 1st. Harbor Lights, of course, is a Salvation Army facility. They clear out the pews each night in their chapel and lay down mats for homeless to sleep on. This is regards that. I stepped off the mats at Skidmore Fountain beneath the Burnside Bridge. First time in nearly 6 years I'd even stopped there. Used to do it nightly and daily. It hadn't changed its 7 o'clock twilight routine. Pitch black by now. Area beneath the bridge was filling with people, waiting for some church group. They grow indistinguishable, bearing gifts, hot dogs, macaroni, pastries, and bananas this particular night. Some kids were sprawled out with their puppies, who were having a great time playing with each other. The kids, on the other hand, looked exhausted. I heard mention of the Blazers meal. A fellow in front of me in the line I joined was asking, "When's the Blazer meal?" "It was yesterday," someone said to him. I asked if he'd been there. He nodded. He was very young and very tired-looking. I asked if he liked the potted ham and turkey, the canned beans. His expression didn't change. A meal's a meal. He reminded me of these two kids I discovered sleeping in a parking garage one morning back in 2001. Hard to believe, seemed so long ago, and Gore had already lost. It was near the downtown library. A Sunday morning, early around 6, having just left Harbor Lights with the rest. It was overcast. It was cold. Can't remember why I ducked in there. Drinking instant coffee out of a mug, a black mug with a Texaco star I'd hid with a KBOO decal. Got hot water and sugar from a convenience store. Shared my instant with one of them. Sat off to the side and waked myself. Thinking of them, I'm also reminded of Stuart, the subject of a book last year, living rough in a parking tower across from the court where he was a familiar. This was in London, England. Stuart seemed harmless and clever and amusing in the book, subtitled A Life Lived Backward, Stuart's Choice. Stuart was an cruelly honest man. He was, in fact, dying and would be dead shortly after the book's publication and before its nomination for the Man Booker Award. When Stuart was living in the parking tower, he lived in a niche at the bottom. He was avoided as a wild, dangerous, feral creature by others living there. He was prone to violence. He had the bottom tier to himself. The kid who took my instant had left a syringe next to his pack. I noticed it as I left. Appearances can be deceiving. Someone harmless now can be dangerous later, and vice versa. Wild, animated now, later an exhausted, pale, impassive child, waiting for hot dogs, leaning against a pylon beneath Burnside, able to do no more than nod to questions. His friends the same, squatting around him. I stood for a while. Someone added to what I'd said about the Blazers' much ballyhooed harvest dinner. Yeah, it wasn't even real turkey. And someone else said, yeah, just a photo op for some millionaires. I left, crossing the tracks to stand in the Harbor Lights line. To wait with the gathered men, there were no women, for a mat on the chapel floor. As in previous years, as on the night before Christmas Eve 2001, the last night I'd been there, the men gathered early, some there before 6, though the doors didn't open till 8:30, and the mats had only been available a week since the 1st. As winter deepened and the cold and wet worsened, though cold, it was in the upper 40s this particular night, it hadn't rained all day and there was no wind. As winter descended on homeless standing in lines, waiting and walking, sitting in the various oases, the library has been recognized by local media recently as the de facto homeless shelter, mental health shelter it's been since the creation. As winter really closed in other words, the line would gather still earlier, the 95 mats pressed tight together inside the chapel, row on row, with narrow aisles between, filling the floor, would become more precious, and there would be mounting overflow. The overflow would be directed across the street to the Portland Rescue Mission, where it, too, cleared the pews each night and laid down 95 mats. Of course, it's a daily feature outside the Portland Rescue Mission to see homeless people hanging out at whatever time of year. I've been there some cruelly, brutally cold nights when mats were laid out down the hall all the way to the front door, filling every possible inch of space. The wind beneath the door notwithstanding, sleeping in that ante area was not life-threatening. Ordinarily, during the overflow time, their doors wouldn't open till 11, 10 if it was raining. They, too, put the people out at 5:30 in the morning. I have stayed with the overflow crowd after a day of whipping rain in the dead of winter and been packed into an infernal scene. Everyone consumed in bellowing, violent hacking and moaning, and flopping like fish on the mats, misery distilled. A rare lower circle of jello. Pache FCC. The reality, as everyone knew, was that a certain percentage of the older white-bearded ones were bound to die, living alone in a crowd in the public eye with not a bit of privacy or dignity or chance left at that point. They usually die alone, invisibly, perhaps in an ER too late, or in a shelter which I've seen and written about, or truly alone, undiscovered till a smell catches someone's attention, which I've also seen and written about. Reality. Housing might prevent this. Health insurance and expansion of now vestigial OHP standard might help this. But there was neither for these men. They only had that inevitable percentage. Tonight, then, was benign. The first in line was laid out on the sidewalk in front of the entry, covered in a yellow blanket trying to sleep. His space was respected by the others. I stood next to a man who'd been looking for work with mixed success. Occasional day labor, carpentry or just fix-it stuff, now gone yard work gigs. Today, no luck. I asked why he was in the line. Why not TPI? Was he on the waiting list? He looked at me like I was stupid. I don't go places where they tell me what to do, he said. I could understand that. But I had always liked the staff of TPI, and he wasn't exactly waiting for his own room tonight. He added with what could be described, I suppose, as a sort of dull, paranoid blink. There's always someone you don't get along with. Well, that's true. We live in an imperfect world, and I'd rather suck it up and sleep warm and dry with a shower in the morning. When you ain't got too many choices, I'd rather just go with the best one and accept it. Better than competing for a mat on the floor squeezed between two huge men fattened by the day-old pastries you find everywhere in homeless day shelters like St. Francis or Blanchet House and elsewhere, but not at the library. The man standing next to me said in the mornings here these days, as before, though I never stayed around for it, there were donuts and pastries and bananas. Bananas, I said. That's good. He agreed. The pastries, he said, didn't do his stomach good. A man named Mike came up to invite us to the Liberation Street Church. At 2nd and Burnside, it was right behind us. Noon, Saturday, turkey dinner, real fresh-cooked turkey. Your Lord Jesus loves you and accepts anyone, he said. He told us we looked like we qualified for saving. I felt oddly reassured by this. We talked. The man next to me stared hard at him and wanted to know if he was being honest. Was he being real? Because if you say you're saved and you give your life to the Lord and you don't truly mean it, Satan will take your bones away. Mike kind of blinked at this but remained smiling. Maybe he too was in touch with how imperfect we all are. Can never be anything but. And that life is so dadgum unpredictable. He explained that he'd spent most of the past 15 years at OCI in the Oregon State Penitentiary. He said when he finally answered the altar call that drew him to the front and his salvation, he was more afraid than when he did the armed robbery that put him in prison in the first place. And, he said, I haven't put a needle in my arm in 15 years. I told him there truly are miracles. At that, Mike grabbed my shoulder. We got a service tomorrow night at 6. You'd be welcome, brother. I told him I couldn't make it, but I'd be there Saturday. The next night's service is, in fact, tonight as I'm speaking to you, as I'm reading this to you over KBU Air. Fire and brimstone service and altar call after altar call, notwithstanding, I assured him I'd be there. He said most of the people who attended, including the minister or the preacher, are ex-cons. You'd feel right at home, he said. I did know some of the people who attended the church and had long been curious to go. Life may be imperfect, but that also means fortuities. Shortly, he left, proceeding to the rest of the line with his invitation. Shortly, I grew tired, had got the point, and left myself, returning to my subsidized apartment in a dual diagnosis place for people who were hope-to-die junkies and juicers, homeless not for, quote, a couple times in a single year, unquote, according to the homeless count, but for decades, on the street dying behind the shiz kebab Pache FCC. Yeah, and we're crazy, too. It's dual diagnosis, a twofer. It was Christmas Eve afternoon that I met with my caseworker in 2001 and was told they had a place for me that would be ready for me to move into in a couple of weeks. A year later, the state legislature, in its right-wing Republican wisdom, defunded the program that employed my caseworker and that got me indoors for good. My first reaction was flat. I didn't believe it. I'd been given assurances of this kind too many times before that didn't pan out, but it seemed reasonable enough. And that night at a Green Party function on Christmas Eve, I was invited to stay at a member's place till I moved in. I haven't been on the street since. It took, in fact, several years to accept my abrupt new situation after so many years. Nowadays, I do. So, I returned to my warm, private, customary place, where I watched a DVD of Sunset Boulevard. I rented from the nearby Clinton Street Video and ate food and drank drink from People's Food Co-op a block down. Things have changed. The only change at Harbor Lights regarded women. They, according to the man standing beside me, no longer slept on the kitchen floor next to the chapel. In 2001, till recently, they would be given blankets, not mats, to sleep on. Men got wafer-like mats, which were nonetheless fine if you were exhausted from walking all day. I would sleep dead to the world practically the whole night once things quieted down and the bickering stopped and people let go for a while. The women, he said, now slept upstairs in their own dorm, on real beds, he'd been told. If that is, you could get up there. There's no elevator for the disabled. I'll talk about this more in a future show. This has been Jay Thiemeyer, reading about the mats being laid down at Harbor Lights. This is KBOO 90.7. Now a music break. But
Welcome back to Hole in the Bucket. This is Michael Anderson. And again, thank you very much, Jay, for that piece. Matt's down at Harbor Light. We just listened to Ovi Wright, A Nickel and a Nail. We're going to shift our conversation a little bit, not too dramatically. We just hearing about Harbor Light and how it opens its doors in the winter downtown in Portland. Now we're going to talk about Washington County, and tonight I believe I am joined on the phone by Eric Cannon. Eric, are you with me?
I am.
Eric, thank you very much for coming on KBOO this evening. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
This is Jay. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
Eric, could tell our listeners a little bit about the severe weather plan for Washington County, what the intention of the plan is, and how it's working out so far.
Well, the severe weather plan came about because of what happened last year. Last year in January, there were some days where the temperature fell down into the 20s, and people started showing up at the four shelters in Washington County wanting space, and there was no space. In fact, the Good Neighbor Shelter in Tigard did create space. They opened and allowed people to stay, but that was pretty much it for the whole county. The county was looking for a place and realizing that they weren't prepared. And as a result, some people got together this past year and decided to do something about it. And they met and formed a plan that is a collaboration between churches and the county to house people when the temperature falls below 30 degrees for an extended period of time. And we are now in the process of trying to sign up churches and bring the plan to fruition.
So, and just for our listeners out here, before we sort of get into this conversation a little bit deeper, now your involvement with this plan is through the Interfaith Coalition on Homelessness out there in your church.
That's correct. We are the Interfaith Committee on Homelessness, and we have been concerned, and also students. We've tried to learn about the issue, and then in addition to that, we've tried to tell people what we've learned, because it's as your show illustrates, it's a nightmare. It's an utter nightmare, and so that the severe weather plan, as an interfaith group, we have members from many churches and many supporters from many churches, and so we have we play a role in this severe weather plan as a result.
Eric, I think a lot of listeners like myself aren't familiar with the homeless situation in Washington County. Mm-hmm. And the lack of services available. Can you describe over the past several years the increase in homeless and the need that they have and how that's being provided for, and, you know, sort of give us a picture of exactly what the situation is for a homeless person and who they are?
Certainly homeless figures are up. You know, the county does a count in January, and this year's count was, I think it was 1561, 1,561 people. But the person who does the count is Patrick Rogers, who administers the Hillsborough shelter, family shelter in Hillsborough. And he always prefaces that number when he brings it up with, That's how many we counted. That's not how many there are. And, you know, I have heard people describe the number as anywhere from that number up to 3 to 4,000 people. And I, you know, I have serious doubts that that's enough. I think there are more. The very fact that a person is homeless is a humiliating thing, a horrible thing. And they hide, and to pretend that we find these people and count their noses is, I think it doesn't really apply. In Washington County, we have four homeless shelters. They do marvelous work. They are staffed by dedicated, wonderful people, but they have been underfunded.
What kind of capacity do they have, all told?
I think it's about, at this point, 120 beds a night.
All together?
That's correct. And that is only families, that is only drug-free people, and no alcohol. The people who are accepted in the shelters go through a rigorous selection process because there is such a shortage. Mm-hmm. You know, the shelters can be very picky, and they don't want to be picky. They'd love to take as many as they could take, but they're constrained by budgetary problems.
I want to ask you a fairly typical question from a person who is unacquainted with homelessness.
Yeah.
If they have it so rough, why do these people stay in Washington County? Why don't they head south?
Why don't they head south?
Just a typical question.
Well,
why don't they go to a better place? Why do they hang around?
Well, first of all, this is not a problem unique to Washington County. Washington County is somewhat unique, at least in comparison with Multnomah County. And I hope I'm right when I say this, that Washington County homeless are anywhere from 60 to 85% families. And that means kids. And that does make us somewhat unique. We don't have, when you look at the demographics in Portland and compare them with Washington County, it's a different situation. But why don't they move? Well, how would they move? I mean, they've been moved out of their house. Where would they go? I mean, the dilemma of being a homeless person, of not having a place of your own, and I'm speaking of if you're walking through town, wherever you might be, in a restaurant. I mean, where do you bathe? Where do you get your phone calls? The whole prospect that they would go someplace else is just another of those sad misconceptions that we have of what homelessness really is.
Well, the kids in the shelters are, I assume a number of them are going to school. Is there provision for tutoring or help with school in the shelter? Do people come in and tutor there, for example?
People who enter the shelter system, first of all, they encourage the kids to stay in the school in which they are enrolled. And because a kid, in order to succeed in school, needs some stability. And so a common school is a real plus. Now, tell me, repeat your question again.
I was asking, I have a dear friend who has tutored homeless kids who were living in a family shelter, and it meant a lot to them. And
uh-huh.
I was wondering if there was that kind of thing, if there were volunteer tutors to help with homeless kids who were might otherwise be really struggling in school because of...
Well, I visited affordable housing complexes, specifically Greenberg Oaks, and that was the case there. They definitely had people who were tuned in to the kids and how to help them. I have not heard that about the shelters themselves, although it wouldn't surprise me that they had people. But, you know, we urge churches specifically to be in relationship with shelters and to work with them and to help them out as much as they can. And so that's not an area where I can answer. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, as it would turn out, I do have a quick answer, which is that we had a young boy on the show about a month ago named Kevin, who stayed out in the Hillsborough shelter, and he did talk about the, I think, whether they call it a homework club or whatever.
Oh.
Yeah, that there was some type of supervision, which is a great thing, and I think gets to some of that more human element that often gets lost in the shuffle of someone's status of housed or homeless.
Yeah.
Eric, I want to go back to the severe weather plan for a second. So, so the county has partnered with churches to try to offset this huge deficit that they have when the temperatures drop.
That's right.
But in order to do that, you have to have churches that are able to engage. I understand there's been some challenges in getting churches to a comfort level where they're actually going to open their doors at this point.
Well, there have been. I think the biggest problem when it comes to homelessness is people's perception of what it is, and they do not realize that, but for the grace of God, there go I. And that's the first challenge with the church. What you're doing with the severe weather plan is opening your door of the church, and you're accepting anybody who comes in. Now, that's not exactly true, because if someone comes in and makes a fuss, if someone is making it difficult for the rest of the people who are there, the church can ask that person to leave, and it's built into the plan that the police and fire departments know which churches are doing this this program and are on instant call. They if the church has trouble, they will call and they'll get a response. But in terms of the average person who goes to church, we're talking about a major leap of awareness and a gamble. I mean, golly, we're going to open our church to who? We don't even know these people. So that's the first hurdle. Second hurdle is insurance. Does the church's insurance cover it? I've talked to a number of ministers, and the consensus is that of course it does. Churches operate that way. They open their doors. They let the public in. But if a person, or a board, or a group of people in the church is fearful of opening these doors, that's an easy tool to grab to say, well, our insurance won't cover us. There are logistical problems such as, in order to open the doors of the church, you have to have people, either church members or members of the community, who would come in and spend the night. And in Washington County, we have a wonderful shelter called Family Bridge. It is one of our four shelters, and it operates during the day out of a house in Hillsborough. But at night, they send they take up to three families. They send their families to churches who open their doors for these families and allow them to sleep and spend the night. They feed them dinner, and then they in the morning they get up and go back to the Family Bridge House in Hillsborough. And that's a wonderful program because, first of all, we see who homeless people are. We see them. And these people are screened. As I said earlier, they have been tested for drugs and those kinds of issues, and they know the rules. They've been told the rules. So it's a good way to ease into the fear of helping our neighbor.
To reverse that, if there's a medical crisis at the and at night, what is there a provision being arranged for that?
As far as I know, it would be 911, and you would tell them what the problem was, and that would be taken care of,
right,
either by the fire department, the ambulance, whatever it is. The county services, this is where we work with the county. The county services are aware of what's going on and at the ready to respond.
Is there a general feeling in Washington County that the homeless did something to deserve it, do you think?
I didn't hear you. Say that again.
Do you get the sense that in Washington County, the overwhelming belief is that the homeless did something to deserve their homelessness?
I think that's typical of what most people believe. You know, the Christian right 8 years ago said that there was a moral crisis in our country. And I think that was right. But I think they got their focus a little bit wrong. I think there is a moral crisis in the country. I don't think that we care anymore about our brothers and sisters and the children of our brothers and sisters who, I mean, if somebody is outside and without a place, how do we respond? Do we look the other way, or do we look their way? You know, I think the typical response of our society today is to look the other way, and with a scowl. And you're quite right in terms of how this is perceived.
I was first homeless in the beginning of the 80s in Atlanta, and at that time you had this immediate army, that, for economic reasons at the time, of at least 5,000 people that you could see them roaming the streets. Just a sudden emergence, just presence of these homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
And only one place, these progressive clerics, they were Presbyterians, they had been involved in civil rights and so on, that were part of Open Door Community, opened up on their own, prompted the church to open up 16 beds.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all there was. You know, in Atlanta, you have 1,000 steeples competing with each other to be the tallest, whitest steeple. And none of them open their doors to the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
Very slowly, they came around. And I'm wondering, now this was almost 30 years ago, the effort that, you know, what they went through, the lessons they learned about dealing with insurance concerns, et cetera, and changing people's view of homeless, has there been an attempt by the interfaith group to say, talk to people in these other cities like NDC, Atlanta, for example, you know, elsewhere, Seattle, Portland,
mm-hmm.
To find out what worked, what were best practices for changing people's minds that, you know, homeless aren't there by choice,
mm-hmm.
that a family, a young single mother with one or more kids, trying to make a life for herself, trying to repair her life and prepare the future for her kids, did not choose homelessness. Is there an effort to look at these other models, in other words?
You know, we have been focused more on the politics of it. We've also tried to tell the story, but in terms of modeling our effort after someone else, we have not done that. And that's a good suggestion. I know that when we went looking for logos for our web page, I was amazed at how many communities have an organization just like ours all over the country.
Yeah.
So we are not unique in any sense of the word. But no, there's a lot of wonderful information out there, success stories out there of how to deal with this problem, and your suggestion is a valid one.
I would suggest very quickly that you Google Open Door Community in Atlanta, because you could get a wealth of information about how they dealt with these things and sort of move that ship around and got people to look at homeless differently and to help them.
I'll do it.
Well, Eric, this has been great having you on the show. Just quickly, if there's listeners out there who have something to offer, perhaps their church in Washington County, they think they could help get their church or their synagogue or mosque involved, who would they call?
Call me. The person you call is Linda Maholt, and let me see if I can get her number here. I'm not ready with that, but my number is 503-357-3282, and I would be happy to refer you to Linda, and I'd also be delighted to talk to you about this. Another person who is very much attuned to this program is Annie Hart at the Family Bridge in Hillsboro, the Family Bridge Shelter. And she's knowledgeable and is more than happy to talk with people about this.
Well, Eric, thank you very much for taking time to come on Hole in the Bucket this evening. I know that on January 11th, you guys are planning a big camp out in Washington County. Do you want to just maybe 30 seconds tell people about it? And we'll bring it up closer to the event.
Well, on the 12th, we're doing an event, and that is a Saturday. But Friday night, there are going to be tents pitched and people out in the wet and or cold, and I hope it's both, and I hope it's extreme, to experience what it is to be outside. And we're going to do that in solidarity with people who are homeless, and we're going to try to raise some consciousness with that effort.
You do wonderful work, Eric. Please keep it up.
So do you, Michael. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Eric.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, Jay, so you're gonna bring us home this evening with another piece that you've put together called Trickle.
Yes, this was prompted by a recent report about the first trickle of Iraqi vets who are turning up homeless. They've already sought services. This is very early in the game. It's unexpected, and it forebodes the New York Times called it a tsunami of homeless Iraqi vets to look forward to. The report focused on the first 400, a trickle. The first trickle of homeless Iraqi vets, the first straws in the wind, homeless so soon. To say that this seven-year-long administration with its nearly five-year-long war has bankrupted this country is not a simply alarmist take on things. It's, in fact, all too real. There's the $9 trillion debt with $2 trillion tax cut for the richest of the rich in wartime. The safety net, including the GI Bill and vets' benefits, and especially VA health care or TRICARE, are on the ropes. There's our lost standing in the world when we support torture and the death penalty. There's the detachment from reality, which grows more truculent by the day, from Cheney Bush and their minions, their yes men, including the ultimate yes man, Condi Rice, Secretary of State of the State of Chevron Oil. The president lives in the ultimate gated community, a bubble reinforced by yes-men and handlers in the White House, and we, the citizens, pay. But the scariest indicator of what's been done to this country is the future we have to look forward to from the preemptive war based on lies and the pursuit of oil. The recent National Alliance to End Homelessness report revealing the early presence, a trickle, of Iraqi vets who are turning up homeless, overwhelmed by their PTSD and brain trauma, with the fallout from DU exposure yet to come, is stunning for what it bodes for the future. What this indicates for the future has long been feared. This report, however, gives its substance a stark statistical verification, giving wind of the nightmare to come. The future for many Iraqi vets is going to be devastating, for them and us as we see them on the streets in their artificial limbs. We've already been deluged with the accounts and images of what the damage from this war looks like in physical terms. Body armor saves lives, but not limbs or traumatized brains. We see these people, dedicated men and women, while there is the attempt at repair, we see them receiving treatment, being retrofitted for a new life. What we see is that these people are being provided for. It won't last. What we don't see is down the road when the supports dry up because of reduced funding and an overwhelmed system and the flashbacks set in, the reality of their situation sets in, and the PTSD becomes an inescapable horror for these young people. The suicide rate, already pronounced, will accelerate. As with Vietnam vets, the flashbacks start in without relenting, only worsening, then the drinking, then the violence toward those closest, the lost job, home, the eventual arrival on the street. The only hope for solution is to intercept this on an ongoing basis, learning from Vietnam, where too many military dealing with PTSD wound up on the street before seeking or receiving assistance. That is going on, but is underfunded in this administration, and what's available is already way short. As with Agent Orange, it's easier for the VA to deny the reality as long as they can. There was plenty of that during the late 70s and 80s. There's plenty of it now. The devastation to be anticipated for those returning vets will be huge. This war has been going on a very long time, nearly 5 years, and Bush will do everything to guarantee it outlasts his regime, that the next one has to solve the insoluble, bear the burden, pay the price for his huge, perverse error. There are a lot of boots on the ground who dealt with IEDs or the fear of them, or their buddies being blown to pieces, even when not killed. They've seen and been impacted by a lot. What they will carry with them from this war will be with them forever. The tough talk we see from soldiers in the various documentaries we see, the soldiers who are in theater today, is just a dam that will burst when they leave and return to us, and they in this country will be flooded by what follows. The needs of these vets deserve our support. This campaign season, we need to hold candidates to account regarding these damaged vets and the need for sufficient funding for their assistance. It's not about continuing this perverse war. It's about anticipating the damage to people's lives, potentially productive young people, men and women, dealing with PTSD and potential homelessness. That is what the focus should be. Meanwhile, the vast majority of Americans surveyed would rather see their money go to children's health care than perpetuation of the Middle East perversity. I almost said the Measure 50 perversity. But the tobacco industry's preemptive war on consumers is of a totally different sort. Of course it is. Presumably, since the vast majority of us also support our returning injured vets, there is, and I imagine will be increasingly, support for this real product of Bush's, Wolfowitz's, Cheney's, Doug Feith's, Rumsfeld's, Richard Pearl's, Condi Rice's war. We need to name the names. The people from the defense policy group chaired by Cheney that configured this war and made it happen to us, to our young brothers and sisters, our children, and our country's future. We must appreciate the immensity of the portent of this NAEH report. The typical NAM vet wound up overwhelmed by his PTSD after 7 to 10 years out of NAM. These were overwhelmingly male, though nurses, for instance, were also in their number. Largely women who had to deal with their inability to save young lives destroyed in another waste of a war. Is there really any other kind? Rich policymakers make wars their own aren't subject to, but the young and the poor are. Anyway, these non-vets typically came back and were working, marrying, going to school, assimilating to the American dream, living normal lives, by and large, benefiting from a GI Bill that was still functional and funded. Before the nightmares, the flashbacks, unanticipated out of nowhere, not comprehended soon enough for too many non-vets who went through Jell-O before getting help or even knowing where to look for it. All they got from the VA was resistance and denial, and worsening nightmares, loss, and too often the street, where many remained and remain, and suicide by the dumpster load. The fact that 400 Iraqi vets are already recorded as receiving services for homelessness resulting from their PTSD and brain trauma after only 1 to 2 years is very scary indeed, especially the fact that the women are recording PTSD from sexual predation by other soldiers. But it's really the numbers that scare me. As the report said, this is just the first trickle, already. And these are only the ones getting help, straws in the wind. Senators Jim Webb and Chuck Hagel, both decorated veterans of the Vietnam War, have already called for an updating of the currently gutted GI Bill. They point to their own experience being provided sufficient support to resettle on their return and get a quality education. Not so for today's returning vets. They're getting not even enough to go to community college, much less Columbia or Harvard Law. This is a tragedy, the result of the Republican right wing and the White House truculence again in the face of funding needs of the people who fight their wars. Hold the candidates to account. This country and its constitution and its health and future are endangered. We need people to do what's already known to do to heal us. Hold the candidates to account and accept no corporate-funded blather. This has been Jay Thiemeyer for KABU.
Good night.
You're listening to 90.7 FM KABU.